This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Depending on who you ask, the election of Donald Trump was either a heaven-sent opportunity or a deal with the devil. A number of conservatives have criticized the president and his surrogates, like former White House strategist Steve Bannon, for abandoning conservative values while pandering to their voters. Those critics include Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. But in his new book, he argues that Donald Trump is not the devil. He's just the brimstone, the acrid aftermath of a persistent problem in the modern conservative movement. It may indeed be the central challenge of all political successes: how to balance your core principles with gaining and keeping power. Senator Flake, welcome to 1A.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What do you hope to accomplish with the book?
Well, I in 1960, Barry Goldwater felt that the conservative movement and the Republican Party had been compromised by the New Deal. 57 years later, I think the conservative movement and the Republican Party is being compromised by populism. That's an unfamiliar standard to most of us in the Republican Party and as conservatives. And I fear unless we get back to traditional limited government, economic freedom, free trade, then we're going to lose a majority.
I wonder if maybe Barry Goldwater is a good place to start, because obviously you refer to him a great deal in the book. The title of your book is borrowed from the title of his 1961 book. Give me an example of some of the core values that you, as kind of a Goldwater conservative, are holding up the highest as you look at kind of remaking today's movement.
One, American leadership abroad. You know, a conservative in foreign policy is nothing if not steady and sober and consistent. And, you know, if you look at our foreign policy today, it's anything but. We've got to recognize our allies and our adversaries, and I don't think we're doing so. That's far from where Goldwater was. Also, with regard to trade, we benefit from free trade. It's a win-win proposition. It's not a zero-sum game. And the administration seems to think that trade deficits are everything, that even if we have trade with Mexico, for example, $600 billion a year almost, where it was only $80 billion, you know, 25 years ago before NAFTA, because there's a $50 billion trade deficit, it's somehow bad. And we're somehow being ripped off. You know, what's not to like about a $600 billion trade with Mexico? So I think a trade and American leadership abroad are two of the areas where we've really drifted from traditional conservatism.
See, and I think that's one of the interesting things about what you're trying to say in the book. A lot of what you wrote about, including just public comportment, I think a lot of people are worried about, including the rise of fake news,
right,
this kind of lack of allegiance to the truth. You include a number of quotes from former presidents and founding fathers, including this one from former President Teddy Roosevelt, who said in December 1903, "No man is above the law and no man is below it, nor do we ask any man's permission when we require him to obey it. Obedience to the law is demanded as a right, not asked as a favor." As a senator, as a sitting senator, where do you see that playing out now the most dangerously?
Well, I mean, I'm always asked, you know, are you loyal to the president? And I will say, I'm not loyal to any man. I'm loyal to the Constitution. You swear an oath when you're elected. You're loyal to the people of the state who sent you to Washington. But no senator ought to be a rubber stamp for any president. And we shouldn't feel that you have to be with the president on every issue. And you know, in this kind of shirts versus skins environment that we're in, you know, if you're not with the president on every issue, you're somehow not conservative, which I find really kind of interesting. But it's an unhealthy situation.
I can imagine that there are a number of people who hear your argument, particularly people who consider themselves liberal, and say, yeah, that's nice, Senator Flake, but I think you've got a different view of conservative politics than the rest of us. I mean, you lay out in your book some of the persistent problems that the conservative movement has had to face, like Senator Joseph McCarthy or the John Birch Society, and even today, the truthers and the birthers and so on. But these things keep coming up. I mean, they keep cropping up in the conservative movement. Is it possible that maybe this really is at the heart of the movement, that this is just baked in and you can't really unravel it because it's in the DNA?
I don't think so. If you look, you know, you'll have extremists who pop up in every, you know, each of the parties. But I point out in the book that in the early 1960s, Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley, you know, were faced with the John Birch Society, who wanted to attach themselves to the Republican Party. Now, they had very extremist views. They felt that Dwight Eisenhower, for example, was, you know, some closet communist. And famously at that time, Barry Goldwater wrote that we cannot allow this emblem of irresponsibility to attach itself to the Republican Party. And they drove the Birchers out. And that was needed at that time.
Well, yeah, but today you have like Richard Spencer in the Alt-Right, and right. You have Donald Trump finally, reluctantly, begrudgingly saying, okay, fine, I disavow, after he's been pushed and pushed.
That's
pushed.
My point.
This keeps happening.
That's my point, that at least it will keep happening. I think both parties have their extreme elements, and you have to continually drive them out. You know, the birther issue is a blight on a lot of Republicans. I think the party as a whole, you know, some of us did stand up, you know, during the period 2008 through, you know, the last election, stand up continually and say that this isn't right for our party. But too many, including the president, trafficked in those kind of conspiracies. And that doesn't speak well for us as a party if we don't sideline that kind of thing. And, you know, for the future, we've got to.
But I can't help thinking about just the human element of this. I mean, bombast feels good. I think the pugnaciousness of a Steve Bannon or a Stephen Miller or Donald Trump, they just feel good. People like to see someone in the ring punching at the people who they think need to be punched. It feels like there's also a human element of this that you're trying to push back against that's really hard to get people to turn off. I mean, victory, revenge just feels good.
Well, it is, and I think when you look at our current political culture, particularly the way the media has evolved, and you look at social media in particular, it rewards those who yell the loudest, who are the most shrill sometimes. You look at the whether it's radio talk shows or the cable shows at night, it's more newsworthy, I guess, to get out and yell and to get after each other and to act pugnacious all the time. But that's not, as I said, it's not a way to govern.
So give me an example. All right, I'm another senator. We won't call a name, but I'm Senator Joshua Johnson, right? And I'm riding this wave, right? I have enjoyed the largesse from Donald Trump, helped me gain some new support, some new campaign contributions, maybe some more followers on social media, and I'm digging this. I'm not sure what the future looks like, but things feel good. I'm hearing from more of my constituents, right on for supporting our president, make America great again. This feels good, and it feels safe. I can get right. Reelected this way. Give me a concrete example of a change you'd like me to make that would hew more to our conservative principles and get me reelected.
That's a good point. And it does, and it is safer, particularly in House races. We've been gerrymandered so well over
sure.
The past you know, several decades.
Well, then let's use that's actually a good example. Let's say I'm Congressman Johnson instead of Senator.
Right,
let's use the House.
It's more difficult in the Senate, but there's still some truth to that as well. I would hope that as an elected official and as a politician, you would put country before party and ask yourself, what am I actually accomplishing here? What, if you're a conservative, what conservative goals are we actually achieving? And I would argue that we've achieved very few.
So are you asking me as a congressman to go sit down with Nancy Pelosi?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Really?
You've got to go with the leadership. That's the only way you're going to get it. If you look at every good budget agreement we've had in the past 40 years, it happened when we had divided government, when both parties realized, hey, we've got to sit down and agree together. It's far easier for a politician we know, for example, take one issue, trade. For a politician to point to a shuttered factory and say, yeah, that was that trade agreement with China or with Mexico, and, you know, that Mexico took your jobs. When the truth is probably a lot more complex than that.
Automation.
Automation, yeah. And you have an auto factory that used to employ 100 people has 12 now. We manufactured twice what we did in the 1980s with one-third fewer workers. And I would argue that most elected officials and politicians know that. I think our president knows that. But it's far easier to point to that shuttered factory and blame trade. But it's irresponsible to do so, because in the end, you're not going to solve the situation by pretending that that it was all due to a free trade agreement. In fact, we're only 5% of the world's population, less than 20% of the world's economic output. How in the world are we going to grow economically if we don't trade actively, sign bilateral and multilateral trade deals? Because the rest of the country will move on without us.
How do you view your own political future in light of what's happening here? You're up for re-election. I don't want to get into what the polls say, whether you're up or whether you're down. There's that old saying, figures don't lie, but liars do figure. Right. I wonder how hopeful you are about your own political future, especially if this present trajectory of conservative and Republican politics maintains. How do you view your future?
Well, I make no bones about the easier route to re-election would have been a little more quiet, not to have written a book, and just kind of lay low and rely on registration numbers in Arizona or elsewhere. But I think the party and the conservative movement is in a bad place right now, and I think it's my responsibility to come out and talk about it when it matters, and it matters now.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. You talk a lot about your faith, and I, as I was reading the book, I kept hearing this verse from Scripture that says, "What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul?" I wonder if you help the conservative movement regain its soul, but you lose this access in the world. If this seat
right.
is given to someone who's more pugnacious and more populist, what then? You won't look back on this as a mistake, will you?
No. In the end, you have to look yourself in the mirror. I have an opportunity to speak up now. And if people say, well, you were critical of the president during the election. And my response would be, when he referred to Mexican migrants as rapists, or when he referred to John McCain in a disparaging way, saying that he couldn't support him because he was captured, or when he referred to an Indiana-born judge as a Mexican in a pejorative way, on which of those issues should I not have spoken up? I would ask that to those in my party. Where should I not have said, this crosses the line? And if we can't stand up for things in decency, put aside substance of policy, but just on the matter of decency, if we can't stand up then when can we stand up? When will we stand up? And so I think it's time that we do.
As it stands right now, do you see any room for working with President Trump? Are there any
Sure.
areas where you're hopeful you could help move him maybe toward a more principled conservative stance, or maybe where you two can work together as things stand right now?
Right. Oh, you bet. I think he named a great Supreme Court justice. I helped shepherd that nomination through the Judiciary Committee, and we're several circuit court judges right now, district court judges that we're working through. On regulatory reform, I think that the regulatory reforms that we in the Congress did with the so-called CRAs, or Congressional Review Act, 14 bills that we passed along working with the president, those were good. So there are a number of things that I'll work with the president on, just as I have other presidents. But boy, if he tries to nullify NAFTA, that's a big deal, and I'll oppose him. The Muslim ban that he announced during his campaign, when he announced that, I think Republicans should have stood up, all of us, and said, that's wrong. Later on, it morphed into the travel ban, which I think is probably constitutional. It's just not wise. Those are things that we ought to stand up on. So with regard to legislation that's being proposed, I'll vote with my Republican colleagues when I think we're headed in a good direction. But when we're not, we have a responsibility to stand up.
And finally, to the American people in general, a plurality of whom describe themselves as independent, many of whom describe themselves as liberal, regarding your argument that the conservative vision for America has the potential to benefit all Americans,
yes.
There are plenty of people in this country who would look at that and say, well, I remember Richard Nixon being the Law and Order president and then masterminding Watergate. And I remember Ronald Reagan speaking of the shining city on the hill and then ignoring the onset of the AIDS epidemic. And I remember the election of Barack Obama and Mitch McConnell stepping out and saying, our mission is to make the first black president in our nation a one-term president. Lies and garbage. Conservatives have never spoken for me. They've never helped me. They've never thought about me. They don't even know me. What would you say to them?
I would say that I'm a conservative because I believe that the principles of conservatism, limited government, economic freedom, free trade, American leadership, have the potential to lead to the most freedom for more people and better standard of living for most people than any other philosophy. I truly believe that. That's why I'm a conservative.
One last question, if I could ask about a policy measure that's pressing right now. Deferred action for childhood arrivals. Congress is considering its future, particularly because President Trump has said it's going to sunset in 6 months. What do you think are the odds right now in terms of Congress finding a way forward on that?
I do think we'll find a way forward. I hope we will. I've always supported the DREAM Act. And I think the fact that 800,000, you know, DACA recipients right now or people are protected by DACA would lose that protection. And when you have people identified who'd registered for a program who would now lose that protection, then that's a lot of motivation to move ahead. Whether it's a standalone measure or we tie it to other immigration reform measures, I don't know. But I believe in the end, even if we have to do it alone, we will get it done.
That's Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake. His new book is called Conscience of a Conservative, A Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle. Senator Flake, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. And I apologize, my voice is just about gone from a cold earlier this week.
That's all right. Thanks for talking to us.
Appreciate it.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.